translation, the merging of the living entity along with his conditional living tendency with the mystic lying down of the Mahavishnu is called the winding up of the cosmic manifestation. Liberation is the permanent situation of the form of the living entity after he gives up the changeable, gross, and subtle material bodies. Purport. As we have discussed several times, there are two types of living entities. Most of them are ever liberated or nitya muktas, while some of them are ever conditioned. Prabhupada elsewhere gives the Sanskrit for that. Usually it's nitya bandha or nitya bandha. The ever conditioned souls are apt to develop a mentality of lording it over the material nature. And therefore, material cosmic creation is manifested to give ever conditioned souls two kinds of facilities. One facility is that the conditioned soul can act according to his tendency to lord it over the cosmic manifestation, and the other facility gives the conditioned soul a chance to come back to Godhead. So after the winding up of the cosmic manifestation, most of the conditioned souls merge into the existence of the Mahavishnu, personality of Godhead, lying in his mystic slumber, to be created again in the next creation. But some of the conditioned souls who follow the transcendental sound in the form of Vedic literatures are thus able to go back to Godhead, attain spiritual and original bodies after quitting the conditioned or the conditional gross and subtle material bodies. The material conditioned bodies develop out of the living entity's forgetfulness of their relationship with Godhead. And during the course of the cosmic manifestation, the conditioned souls are given a chance to revive their original status of life with the help of revealed scriptures, so mercifully compiled by the Lord in his different incarnations. Reading or hearing of such transcendental literatures helps one become liberated even in the conditional state of material existence. All the Vedic literatures aim at devotional service to the personality of Godhead. And as soon as one is fixed upon this point, he at once becomes liberated from conditioned life. I love all this optimistic language from Prabhupada. Very encouraging, isn't it? The material gross and subtle forms are simply due to the conditioned soul's ignorance. And as soon as he is fixed in the devotional service of the Lord, he becomes eligible to be freed from the conditioned state. This devotional service is transcendental attraction for the Supreme on account of his being the source of all pleasing humors. Everyone is after some pleasure of humor for enjoyment, but does not know the supreme source of all attraction. And then Prabhupada quotes here, raso vai saha rasam hyevam, hyevayam labdvanandi bhavati. This is from the Taittiriya Upanishad. Prabhupada doesn't mention it here, but it's from the Taittiriya Upanishad 2.7.1. Very famous passage. We'll talk about that in a minute. The Vedic hymns inform everyone about the supreme source of all pleasure. The unlimited fountainhead of all pleasure is the personality of Godhead. And one who is fortunate enough to get this information through transcendental literatures like Srimad Bhagavatam becomes permanently liberated to occupy his proper place in the kingdom of God. I'm somewhat amused by the very last words. Kingdom of God. When do we ever talk about the kingdom of God? We talk about Brajlok, right? So this is like going into a Christian church, and if I gave a talk and said, all of you eventually could go back to Brjlok, you know. They speak about the kingdom of God. We speak about Brjlok, the world of Braja, the world of Krishna, Krishna Loka. So Prabhupada would engage sometimes the language of the Western traditions to help Westerners bridge over to the Vaishnava understandings and concepts. But let's start at the beginning. The Nitya Muktas and Nitya Badhas, our whole theology, our whole metaphysics is set up to accommodate love, the pure love originating in the heart, lying dormant within the heart. And love requires freedom of choice. Love cannot be forced. Love is not something to be manipulated. Love, you cannot threaten someone to love. You cannot arrange for someone to love. It is something that will naturally flow from the heart. And this is what devotional service accommodates, is the ability for the living entity to naturally have this generous flowing of the heart toward others and toward the divine. But Prabhupada says the ever-conditioned souls are apt to develop a mentality of lording over material nature. We hear this phrase a lot in Prabhupada's discourse. What does that mean, lording over material nature? I mean, no one's particularly good at it, have you noticed? I mean, I've tried it a number of times, and I am not good at it. So I've given up. But what does it mean to lord it over? Lord means the center. Lord, what is the word for Lord in Sanskrit? Ishwara. And if you take the word apart morphologically, you can understand it's Isha and Vara. And sorry if I'm waxing a little Euclidean here, but Isha means the circumcenter, and Vara means the circumference. The very center, the innermost essence of all reality, containing the whole of everything. Ishwara. So the very center. So to be lording it over means that I think of myself as the center, and all of you are simply my little minions that do exactly what I want you to do. I want to control you. I have expectations of all of you. And I am the center, and all of you are just very secondary. Devotional service reverses that. Suddenly, I'm no longer the center, but divinity is the center. And the divinity within all hearts is the center. And each of you become the center when I speak with you. So the first covering of the soul, of the Atman, we know, is the Ahankara, right? Which means, I mean, you could literally translate Ahankara as making the I the center. Self-centeredness is the Ahankara. Seeing everything in light of the eye. So I made up a Sanskrit word that is the antidote to Ahankara. I call it Anyakara. Making the another the center. Being centered upon another is really the antidote to making oneself the center. And then ultimately, Paramanyakara, being centered upon the Supreme Other. That is our process. Prabhupada came to show us how to go from the self-centered orientation to all existence and become oriented totally to other-centeredness, alter-centrism, we might call it, alter-centrism. So this is the process of devotional service. Now, this is not something forced. This is something that is facilitated either to remain in the ahankara mode or the anyakara mode, and to facilitate both eternally. Again, you cannot force love. If you could force love, it wouldn't be love now, would it? I don't know if I've told this funny story before here. But in the university, you know, the in-between classes, sidewalks become crowded with, you know, people going to their next class, right? So I'm in a crowded sidewalk, and I'm behind two young ladies who are obviously going to their class. And yes, I confess, I was eavesdropping, okay? Okay, let's just get that out. I was eavesdropping. And I heard one say to the other, "Does Mike still love you?" And she responded by saying, "He better or I'll kill him." Do you understand the effect this had on me? I'm thinking, oh my, I started looking around. Where's Mike? I've got to tell him that there is a bounty on his soul. So for years I've been looking for Mike, and I think he's dead, honestly. I got a lot of false calls. I put signs up around the university. "Are you Mike? I need to speak with you urgently." A few mics showed up, but these were obviously not the mics. I think he's missing. I think he's gone. The point being that either Mike confessed his love to her because he was under duress, or he was honest with her and he's dead. So it's a bad situation, no matter how you look at it. It's a bad situation. Love cannot be forced. Krishna is not that kind of person who threatens us to love him. Yeah, there was another situation where I was waiting for, oddly, it was in some mall. I was waiting for a haircut years ago, many years ago. And I got there early, and she said, "You know, you're early." And I don't like to sit in those places, so I said, "I'll be across the hall, and you know, perhaps you can yell for me when you're ready." So I'm looking at the jewelry counters that the, you know, in the jewelry store, and saleswoman comes up to me. She had a name tag. Her name was Deborah, and she said, "Are we getting something for the wife today?" And I said, "Well, I should have said yes, okay, to Krishna Kanta. I always like to get something for Krishna Kanta. But I said, "No, I'm just waiting for my haircut." And she said, "Okay, so what do you do?" And I said, "I'm a professor." And she asked, "A professor of what?" And I told her, and she said, "Have you written any books?" And I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I just came out with a book published by Princeton," and told her a little bit about it. She said, "I guess no one is going to go back to heaven reading your book now, are they?" I said, "I'm sorry? I'm sorry. She said, "Professor, do you know what fear is?" No, she said, "No. Do you know what suffering is?" I said, "I'm beginning to know what it is." She said, "If you don't give your life to..." I said, "Well, okay, Deborah, wait, just wait. I know where you're going. And let me tell you, let me save you some time. I would rather go to hell than to go to a heaven where a God felt he had to force me to love him, because that would be an even greater hell." She was kind of like, now luckily, yeah, "Graham, your haircut." She said, I said, "Deborah, it's been great speaking with you today." So I'm going across the hall, and she said, "Professor," I turned around, I said, "Yes." She said, "I don't feel forced to love Jesus." I said, "That's good, Deborah. But it's not beneath you to try to force others. Now, is it? And then I walked on. Have a good day. Yeah, don't mess with me. I'm a professor of religion. I know all this stuff. The matter is that you cannot force someone to love anything. It is a natural, bubbling up of the heart toward a very attractive and beloved object. Krishna accommodates whatever we want. If we want to live a kind of self-centered existence, he will arrange for that. Eternally. Nitya Baddha. Or we can go to the other side. We can choose to live an eternally liberated life. Liberated, what does that mean? Liberated from a conditioned existence and totally freed into the life of the heart. This is the beautiful metaphysics that we have in Krishna Bhakti. Krishna waits an eternity within our hearts and waits for us to turn to him. We were just discussing that last night and even on Sunday, I think. The way Arjuna didn't see Krishna for who he was in the chariot in the first chapter. He was oblivious to Krishna being right there in his chariot. Well, are we aware that Krishna's right there in our chariots, our bodies? That's what this whole process is about, to be able to interact with the divinity in the heart. So there is, of course, Mahavishnu, as Prabhupada speaks of it here, or Karana Dakashai Vishnu, who is in charge. That extension of Krishna, the Vishnu form that is in charge of the whole cosmic manifestation. And then there's Garbha Dakashai Vishnu, who is in charge of each, or was in the sort of center of each of the universes, from whom Lord Brahma comes and creates the rest of the universe. And then there's Kshiro Dakashai Vishnu, the Lord in the heart. So Krishna's got us covered. He is embracing us everywhere. Everywhere. He is embracing us from without. He is embracing us from within. Kshiro Dakashai Vishnu. He's embracing us from without. Karana Dakashai Vishnu and Garbha Dakashai Vishnu. But this is not a forced embrace. This is not like a trap. We have a choice. We can leave this material cosmic manifestation, or we can stay right here. Now, if we're going to stay right here, it's best to come to the manor. Okay. Then that's a little reprieve from the phenomenal manifestation. So that's what all of us are doing here. We decided, hey, you know what? This isn't such a great thing, this Nitya Baddha. I think maybe we'll start shifting over to the Nitya Mukti. So this is what a beautiful place like this is for. But Prabhupada says here, those who follow transcendental sound in the form of Vedic literature are able to go back to Godhead. And during the course of the cosmic manifestation, the conditioned souls are given a chance to revive their original status of life with the help of revealed scriptures, so mercifully compiled by the Lord in his different incarnations, and particularly Vyasadeva, whom he empowers to compile the great literature. Now, the Vedanta Sutra, now there, of course, the literature is very extensive. We've got 18 Puranas. There is the Itihasa, like the Mahabharata. There's the Vedas. And part of the Vedas is the Upanishads. And the Vedanta Sutra is a distillation of the essential teaching of all of the Upanishads. It's about 550 aphorisms. I don't have an exact number. Does anyone, do you know an exact number? 550, is it? Yeah, 550. Okay, so 550 aphorisms. And the last aphorism is extremely dramatic and relevant to what Prabhupada is saying here. It's dramatic because not only is it the last aphorism, but no other aphorism in all of the Vedanta Sutra, I'm pretty sure, I've read it several times, no aphorism repeats itself within the aphorism. This is the only one that does that. Anavrati Shabdat. Anavrati Shabdat. So powerful. There is no returning on account of Shabda, sound. There's no coming back to this phenomenal manifestation because of sound. So it's powerful. Vedic literature is meant to liberate. It's easy to tell Vedic literature from other literature. Try reading other literature. See if you can feel like, you know, you can feel it kind of closing in on you. It doesn't feel liberating. It feels sort of entrapping. You know, it kind of grabs you and brings you back into the material manifestation. When you read the Vedic literature, you are lifted up. You can feel the difference. I'd like to, we have a place like this, such a beautiful, beautiful temple. And, you know, we call that in my profession sacred space. Sacred space. And of course, you know, in England, you have, of course, many cathedrals, right? We've got gorgeous, like, you know, very grand cathedrals. And of course, these cathedrals very much subscribe to the sort of Aishwarya Bhava, right? You walk in and you are like stunned by the majesty of this space, the cavernous space that's caught within the walls of, say, Westminster Abbey, you know, or King's College, chapel. I mean, it's extraordinary. You can feel the sacredness of the space. And then there's the more intimate space. We were just, Yadavarji and I were talking about Tirupati, the Tirumal Tirupati Devastanam, Balaji deity. So Yadavar's telling me that he had the good fortune of going and taking darshan of Balaji with Srila Prabhupada. So he's a very spoiled individual. And that's just one of many, many opportunities he has had with Prabhupada directly. So we were talking about the huge complex of Tirupati. It's huge. It's up a mountain and it is huge. The first time I ever learned about Tirupati was from Bhakti Swarup Damodar, when we used to take japa walks together in Boston in 1977, when the Bhaktivedanta Institute was there. Every morning, we would take a japa walk to the Boston Commons and the Boston Garden. And he would say, I said, Garuda, have you been to Tirupati? You know, he had that, I don't know if any of you knew him, but he had that sort of buoyant voice. And strangely enough, he would always say, when I first would meet with him, he said, Garuda, have you had Rasgulla recently? I said, no, but I would really like one if you know where one is, you know. He had a thing about Rasgullas. To this day, I have no idea why. But he was always very jolly, Swarup Damodar. It was a wonderful association. So, Tirupati, he was, I think, instrumental in getting our temple in Tirupati. I think Bhakti Swarup Damodar was the one to precipitate that occurring. So, Jai Shri Shri Radhika Gokulakananda. So you go into this elaborate complex of buildings, and when you finally have darshan of Balaji, you come into this very intimate, small setting And really, it's just you and Balaji. There's not much room for anyone else. So this is so opposite a cathedral. In the West, we've got the key. You walk in and you're absolutely drowning in majesty, Aishwarya. And with Balaji, you start with the majesty, but you go into the intimate realm of the deity. This is our tradition. You go from Aishwarya to Madhurya. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is said to state in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, according to Krishnadas Kaviraj, all the world is enamored by Aishwarya. But I have come to deliver Madhurya, the sweetness of divinity. This is what I have come to deliver, the sweetness of divinity. The love between Radha and Krishna, the love exchanged within the most intimate dimension of divinity, and how we can participate in that ultimately. That's amazing. That's the gift. That's the gift that Prabhupada brought. Let's jump down here to Raso Vai Saha. Rasam Hivayam Labdhanandi Bhavati. This is a very, very powerful statement. First of all, the subtext is, my dear Buddhist, go away. You have no place here in this theology. My dear Advaitin, go away. You have no place here in this theology. Rasa, truly, is the absolute reality. Because one here in this world, who, having attained rasa, becomes one who is supremely joyful, anandi. So one here who attains that rasa, who can participate in that rasa, is supremely joyful, anandi. So that is what we're doing here. I have some, I engaged some quotes from Prabhupada that I think are just so beautiful that I'd like to read to you, because I think you'll benefit more from hearing his words than what I have to say on this subject. Therefore, Bhagavatam says that type of religion, which is executed simply to develop the dormant love, everyone has got dormant love of God. That is natural because we are all parts and parcels of God. Prabhupada will sometimes blurt out Anandamayo Vyasat from the Vedanta Sutra. Because the essence of the Lord is this supreme joy. And that is natural for all of us to revive that in the essence of our beings. Actually, we are teaching the science of God. We are teaching how to develop our dormant propensity to love God. Being parts and parcels of the Supreme, we have got an eternal affinity to love God. Unfortunately, by our contact with matter, we have practically forgotten that we are eternally related to God. Beautiful quote, isn't it? Pure love for Krishna is eternally established in the hearts of the living entities. It is not something to be gained from another source. When the heart is purified by hearing and chanting, this love naturally awakens. This is our process. Krishna has the propensity to love someone of the opposite sex. Listen to how Prabhupada puts this. And therefore, we have the same propensity. The beginning of love is present in the eternal love between Radha and Krishna. We are also seeking eternal love, but because we are conditioned by the material laws, our love is interrupted. But if we can transcend this interruption, we can take part in loving affairs similar to those of Krishna and Radharani. Aren't these extraordinary quotes? They're beautiful. So, our theology is set up, in one sense, very simply, although it ramifies in very complex directions. There is the possessor of Shakti, Shaktimat or Shaktiman, and then there are the three Shaktis. There is the Antaranga Shakti, the Bahiranga Shakti, and the Tatastha Shakti. Wait, what else is it called? Wait, Antaranga, Bahiranga, and what's the other term? It is Tatastha Shakti, right? But then there's also Chit Shakti, Maya Shakti, and Daivi Shakti? No, because then there's the Jiva. Maybe Jiva Shakti. Anyway, you know, these are categories that can be described in various ways. These are three irreducible categories of existence, of reality. In the Advaitin conception, there are no categories. There just is. That's it. And the conception is that when we leave this mortal coil, that our consciousness merges with an ocean of consciousness. And individuality is totally lost. And their metaphor is, you know, a drop joins the ocean, and you can no longer distinguish what is the ocean from the drop. It merges. Prabhupada's example is rather that when you take an iron rod, the closer it gets to the fire, the more it takes on the qualities of fire. The rod still remains a rod, but it takes on the qualities of the fire. Now, as I'm translating the Yoga Sutra with the Bhakti Valochana, the eye of Bhakti, things are brought out of the Yoga Sutra that, honestly, I think many people will be surprised to read. For example, the Yoga Sutra begins with Samadhipada. Patanjali begins with the perfection, which is nothing less than Ishvara Pranidhana. Discovering, moving deeply within the very core of the self, moving very deeply into the space within the heart. Pranidhana. To discover and to relate to divinity, the supreme source of all reality, Ishvara. This is Samadhi. After the Samadhi Pada, Patanjali becomes a little self-conscious and says, oh, dear reader, maybe you're not there yet. Okay, so let's not talk about perfection. Let's talk about Sadhana Pada. Let's talk about Sadhana, how you can get there. So then he says, before Ishvara Pranidhana, there is a tapas, and Swadhyaya, and then there's Ishvara Pranidhana. And he calls that Kriya Yoga. And then halfway through the Sadhanapada, he goes, you know what? I think I better break it down further for you, okay? So let's talk about the Ashtanga system. And he talks about Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi. And without going into these, and many of you know these already anyway, but without going into any of these, it's interesting because the first five of these angas, limbs, the ethical practice disciplines, ethical yamas, the personal practices, sacred personal practices, niyamas, asana, positioning of the body, pranayama, the deepening of the breath control, and pratyahara, which typically means withdrawal of the senses from sense objects. He ends the chapter, the sadhanapada, with the fifth limb and saves the last three limbs for the beginning of the third pada, which is called vibhutipada. Now, this is the clincher. Vibhuti means power. But most interpreters of the Yoga Sutra think it's the power that belongs to the yogis. Wrong. Vibhuti belongs to the Lord, not to the yogi. Vibhuti, and you know, it's so funny for me to read some of the other commentaries. The miraculous things that yogis are able to do are somewhat mentioned in this pada. And they're all really embarrassed because many of these yogis can't even get near these siddhis. And yet they feel like they're supposed to be kind of godly, full of power. But vibhuti belongs to the Lord. And what happens is, because of the yogi's greater and greater proximity to Ishwara, with the deeper connection of the heart of the yogi to the supreme heart of the Lord, some of the divine powers spill over into the yogis. And that's how they have any powers at all, because they belong to the Lord, not to the yogi. And this has never been understood. I've never read that in any understanding of the Yoga Sutra. And the way we get that understanding is by reading the Bhagavatam and the Gita. Vibhuti belongs to the Lord. The siddhis that one might attain or develop incidentally to their relationship with Ishwara, their loving ultimate relationship with Ishwara, those siddhis may come, they may go. But the power, any power belongs to the divinity. So, again, the danger for yogis when they attain some of these siddhis, thinking, oh, well, then we can go to the 16th chapter of the Gita. Ishwaroham, humbogi, siddhoham, balavan, sukhi. Right? I am Ishwara. Right, here we go, lording it over again, right? I did all this work to become a great yogi and powerful. Now, Ishwaroham, I am Ishwara. I mean, what would you do to me if I walked around the temple saying, Ishwaroham? I would hope you would say, Garuda, would you please leave? Ishwaroham. Ahambogi, yes, I am the supreme enjoyer, ahambogi, siddhoham, I am perfect. Siddhoham balavan, I'm very powerful. Suki, very happy. Very, very happy. This is not happiness. This is isolation. This is loneliness. The nature of all reality is rasa, is relationships. And we have the opportunity to develop that rasa even right here between one another. This is why it is so important, even when we disagree with one another, that we engage in dialogue. I've had people write to me saying that they read something I've read and written, and they disagree. And I said, well, let's talk about it. Let's engage in dialogue. And often they graciously do engage in dialogue. And we each learn something from one another. But those who don't accept the invitation to dialogue, they run away from rasa. That is not our process. Our whole process is to dialogue. I mean, the Gita would be totally different if Arjuna said, Krishna, I know you have a lot to say to me, but I'm not interested. I know you're powerful. I know, you know, I can see on your face you don't like my freaking out right now. But I don't want to hear anything from you. That's not our process. Our process is dialogue. Shishyasteham shadimam aham prapanam. I submit myself unto you. I am your student. Occasionally I get an email, you know, what you've written is totally wrong, this is bogus, you've insulted our spiritual master, you know, and so on. And you know, you shouldn't be writing about Krishna, because Prabhupada says, unless you're a pure devotee, you should not be writing about Krishna. I think all of you know me well enough that I'm likely to respond with this obnoxious response. How do you know I'm not a pure devotee? If you know I'm not a pure devotee, you must be terribly powerful, because you've never even met me. So how you can know this is amazing. So you are my guru. Please instruct me. I submit myself unto you. And they never respond. The whole point is engage in dialogue. Share. Machitta magata prana. Give. Our hearts belong to Krishna. Our very life airs belong to Krishna. We offer them to Krishna. Then what happens? Bodhayanta parasparam. Then we can enlighten one another. Then we come together to enlighten one another. And what happens then? Katyantascha mam nityam. Then we're in dialogue forever. Unending dialogue. That is our process. And that is completely satisfying and very enjoyable. Tushanticha, Ramanticha. Anyway, there's so much more we could say here. But I'm sure we have a lot to talk about. So why don't I open up for comments and questions? Corrections. Yeah, corrections. Anything. From anyone. Yes, Govindaji.
Hari, thank you for your interesting class. I've got a question. You mentioned Krishna's not enamored by worship that's with awe and reverence. Then we have the pastime of Ambarish Maharaj and Vishnu, and it seems that Vishnu is very much enamored by Ambarish Maharaj. And I'm always wondering, does that mean for Vishnu, he's conquered by worship with awe and reverence? He's actually conquered by it, and he has this loving exchange with his devotees, whereas only Krishna, he doesn't get conquered by that.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. I mean, there is definitely a place for Aishwarya in our tradition, but usually to highlight Madhurya, ultimately, just as we see in the Gita, the 11th chapter, there's plenty display of Aishwarya in the Virata Rupa, which ultimately scared the bejabbers out of Arjuna. And he much preferred the intimate form of the Lord. But yes, there are ample pastimes that utilize the, you know, that showcase the Aishwarya. But ultimately to emphasize the greatness and the supreme position of Madhurya. That's the idea, you know. In a way, you could say that the Aishwarya is sort of like a frame for the picture of Madhurya. You could say that, you know. I mean, there's Brahman, there's Paramatman, and there's Bhagavan. And Bhagavan is situated, you know, ultimately through and in Brahman and Paramatman, which tend to be, you know, the Brahman, the totality of reality, within which, of course, there's the internal manifestation of the divine within the heart of all living beings. And then there's Bhagavan coming face to face with the Lord and his leelas entering his leelas. And Prabhupada says over and over, we are meant to go back to Godhead. We are meant to join Krishna in his leelas. And he also mentions we're meant to join the dance, to join the rasa dance. He says that many times. It's little known, but he says this. There was a time when devotees said, yes, read the Bhagavatam, read cantos 1 through 9, and when you get to 10, probably shouldn't read that. Especially you should not read the 5 chapters, the Rasa Panchadhyayi. I literally heard this in the 90s, right? And so when I was in graduate school, and I was planning to do a dissertation on really quite something different than what I ended up doing, it was my doctoral mentor who forced me to write about the Rasleela. Now, this was back in the 90s. Now, how was I to tell my god brothers and god sisters, guess what I'm writing on? All the stuff you tell everyone not to read. That's a little bit, it's tantamount to saying to a Christian, set up your church, but don't put the cross in there. It's too intimate. Our supreme vision is Radha and Krishna. Supreme vision is Radha and Krishna. And the Ras Mandala is but a manifestation of Radha and Krishna, because each of the Vrajagopikas in the circle dance are but individual or embodiments of the individual emotions of Radharani. So when you're looking at the Ras Mandala, you're looking at Radha Krishna. When you're looking at Radha and Krishna, you're looking at the Ras Mandala. The difference is that the Ras Mandala is the inward gaze of divinity, and Radha Krishna, they're gazing outward at us, and they're calling us to their divine hearts. I mean, look, just look at them. I mean, look, see for yourself. They're not looking at each other as in the Ras Mandala. They're looking at us. They're calling us to their divine hearts. That is our process, is to respond to that love call. What is that response? Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. When someone's calling you, you know, it's nice to respond, you know. I mean, if someone calls me, if Yadavarji calls me and says, hey, Garuda, and I just walk by and ignore him, I mean, you might think I was rather rude. Well, Krishna's been calling us for an eternity, and we've been rather rude. Except we've come here to return the response finally. Isn't that a blessed situation? So that's the madhurya that we focus on ultimately. And the Maha Mantra is all about the Madhurya. It is not about the Aishwarya. But the Aishwarya has a place. Arjuna had to go through the Aishwarya in the 11th chapter to appreciate the Madhurya. So sometimes that happens. Yeah, it's good. Lots of good things to think about in that regard. Thank you, Govindaji.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Prabhuji, on Saturday, Yadav Prabhu said to me that you have to come and listen to Garuda Prabhu because he's my favorite speaker.
And the who said that?
Yadav Prabhu.
This Yadav?
And the past 3 days have been extraordinary, so please come back again. We've absolutely loved your classes. They've been so enlightening.
You're very generous, and Yadav was lying to you. He has it. He has that. Look, he's a filmmaker. Come on. Films are all fake. I mean, that's what that, yeah, they make you believe things, right? I mean, so it's the suspension of disbelief is all about the art of filming, right? He's like just an ongoing film himself, so. What's that? I love your film. I especially loved Prabhupada watching your film. That was, I'll never forget that, watching Prabhupada watch your film.
Thank you, Prabhuji. And my question.
Yeah, thank you.
Prabhuji, so you mentioned the word Nitya Buddha and Nitya Siddha.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a question about the first term. Because of your Sanskrit and also your scholarly aspect, I wanted to share with you, do you feel that the term is slightly misleading, Nitya Buddha, Nitya Siddha, because they obviously get to a point where they are no longer Nitya, but they're Anitya?
Yes.
So is the term misleading? And if it's not misleading, what is it trying to portray by placing the word Nitya in this phrase?
Mm.
This is my question.
Yeah, nice, nice. You know, our theology is more fluid than we sometimes think. Sometimes we reify concepts. We make them more concrete than they actually are. You know, I have to say, you know, in the West, we're very binary. We're very, you know, something's either yes or something's no. And, you know, living in India for a year on a Smithsonian grant taught me a lot. You know, I went up to a restaurant in Delhi, and I said, and of course you have to speak, most people speak English, but you really, when you're living there, you end up having an Indian accent. I mean, it just makes sense because you're understood better. So I go up to the head of the restaurateur and I say, Bhai Saab, is this restaurant veg or non-veg? And he goes, Acha. Acha. I don't know if I'm doing it right. It's been a while. And, you know, what that does to a Westerner, it's so abrasive. Because all I wanted was a yes or a no. Why is that so difficult? And then I say, Bhai Saab, you have veg? You're a veg restaurant? He says, Acha. Aye, aye, you know. So what does the head wobble mean? Head wobble means yes, it means no, it means maybe, maybe not, all of the above, none of the above. All at the same time. The subtext is, it depends on your angle of vision. It depends on your perspective. Now, this is, I think, what is most frustrating for a Westerner, but it's also the genius of Indian mind, the Indian mind, is that it has the ability to grasp beyond the binary. And so, yes, sometimes terms are, you know, they seem rather fixed, but they're much more fluid, as you well know. I mean, the terms are, I'm trying to think of one that I recently encountered. But you're right. The Nitya can be a bit misleading, as you said, because once you're, you know, a Nitya Buddha, that's become a Nitya Mukta. So how are you a Nitya Buddha in the first place? So you're no longer Nitya. But as far as everyone else was concerned, you're Nitya if you don't do anything about it. So, you know, again, it takes elaboration, requires elaboration. So, but look at the task of theology in general. Talking about the unlimited with limited language. And you see in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami struggling with this. You know, how do you speak about something so supremely beautiful and magnificent, something so extraordinary? How do you put that in language? How do you take the unlimited and place it in a limited form without limiting the unlimited? That's the key. And this is, of course, the challenge in understanding the deity. How does the supreme unlimited Lord Krishna come into a limited form and still remain unlimited? Well, this is the power, this is the divinity's, prerogative. He can take any form he wants. He can enter into it with as much saturation of divinity or less saturation. That is his prerogative. You know? One devotee asked me if I was an Uttama Bhagavat. Now, of course, my mind said immediately, oh, of course. I said, you know, that's something for Guru and Krishna to determine. That's not something that I can even know. So we'll leave it at that. I do know that Krishna is powerful enough that if he wants me to say something that is at an uttama level, that I could, despite me. Now, when devotees tell me that, oh, I'm not an uttama, I'm just a prakrita bhakta, a prakrita kanishta bhakta, you know? I said, wow, do you really know that? How do you know that? Can we really judge ourselves? Can we really judge others? I don't think so. First of all, we're very complicated people. Have you noticed how complicated people are? I mean, look at Yadavar. He's extremely complicated. Well, you don't know him the way I know him. I told you I wasn't going to pick on you today, but it's just so irresistible. The friendship has been so long, it's irresistible. But seriously, people have many sides to them. They're complicated. While there can be flaws, there can be wonderful qualities. How to negotiate all of that? The movement has a hard time with that sort of thing. How does someone do so much devotional service and yet they've also done a lot of harm at the same time? This struggle, you know, these struggles, there were these struggles if they're truly addressed. But if we try to address them in a kind of binary fashion, then I think we have trouble, then we have problems. We have to consider things very carefully and very sensitively. And again, in dialogue. I remember that at my godbrother, Guru Garanga, he started the Ministry of Justice, which the GBC had a long time ago, but they closed it down for whatever reason. I guess I don't think they were interested in justice anymore after that, I guess, or whatever, I don't know. But Guru Garanga said that they looked into this one sannyasi who had been transgressive, and they looked at all the data, looked at all the evidence, looked at all the facts, and they said that they found him guilty of all of these, you know, transgressions. So he's telling me about his first case. And I said, oh, okay, sounds like it's been working. And then he said, and our recommendation was that this sannyasi should become a grihastha. I said, what? What? Wait a second. He's been having transgressive activities with many women, and now you're recommending him to be a grihastha? This is the qualification for a grihastha? The poor woman that has to marry that man. No, he does not have a qualification to be a grihastha. We have to be very careful in what we recommend, what we offer to others. Grihastha ashram is not like the when nothing else works, you just throw them in the grihastha ashram. That's not what the grihastha ashram is for. That's what it used to be thought of. Like, yeah, this is not working out. Hey, you're a lousy brahmachari, you know. Get married. Sannyasa is not working out. Yeah, get married. You know. You're a terrible, terrible devotee. You're slacking yourself. Just get married. You're a horrible example of Krishna bhakti. Get married. This is what it used to be. But actually, the best kept secret is, you know, marriage is the best place to find out where all your faults are. That's what I tell people. I said, you know, sometimes devotees, young devotees come up to me and say, so what is the best method of purification? Get married. You want to find out where all your faults are? Get married. It's an ashram of purification and great responsibility. You know, there are grihasthas with children and without children. These are two different ashrams. If you have not had children, you do not know what the grihastha ashram is. And it's funny because I was two leading devotees, one a sannyasi, one a grihastha, were trying to get me to cooperate with certain ISKCON parameters, which I won't get into. Well, whatever. And you know, it was funny because I suddenly realized neither of them ever had children. I said, you know what? You guys don't know anything. Until you've raised children, raised another human being in Krishna bhakti, you don't really know what it's like to take care of another soul. These are the special dispensations of the Grihastha Ashram. There's so many teachings that are there in the Grihastha Ashram. Don't be fooled. This is not a low ashram. In fact, it is the most difficult ashram because you're maintaining a family. You have to liberate your dependents and you have to bring in a little bit of money. And usually it's a job that's difficult. It's out in the world. It's very worldly, except for a professor. My job is going in 6 hours a week. And what do I have to do at the university? Teach Bhagavad Gita. I am spoiled rotten. What do I have to do? Teach yoga philosophy. And this is a whole 6 hours a week. It's very taxing. No, I mean, teaching takes a lot of energy, right? And they make me do it for a whole 8 months of the year. They only give me 4 months off. Yeah, only 4 months. I have to make very good use of those 4 months. But to get there was a devil of a thing. Okay, that was the real tapas, to go through all that I had to go through. I tell you, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. Very, very difficult. Others are more suited to academics than I. So, but I got through it. Any other comments, questions? Now, what about the ladies? Let's share, make it a little balanced here. Yeah, I'm missing my dancer. Remember on Sunday we had a dancer here.
Nitya Shekhar, he's amazing.
Yes, he was the dancer. Yeah, you're okay, but you're not a dancer.
Prabhu, what is the connection between the Ishwarya Bhav and the Madhurya Bhav? Because let me just give you my pondering.
Yeah.
When I was reading the third chapter, was it the third of the 10th canto? You know, the father of, well, gosh, the name just, I just got lost.
Oh, are you?
Krishna's father.
Nandamaharaj, I mean.
No.
No, Krishna's father.
Vasudev, yes.
Oh, Vasudev, okay, okay, right.
He makes this prayer, and he goes on from, like, the unmanifested to the, you know, he really describes this Sankhya thing.
Yes.
And I was just like, this is funny. Like, your child has been born, you know, is the Lord and who's got four hands. And he suddenly goes into this huge, super, you know, all in reverence
right.
mode. And describes these little details about the creation. I was like, why is he doing that, you know?
Yeah.
And then you mentioned Yoga Sutra, which is, I don't know, maybe there's like a midway between, you know, your Ishwarya, and because that's a method to mm-hmm. understand how the Ishwarya or the grand scheme of things apply to your personal experience, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come to Madhurya.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't there like a... So is it necessary for every soul to go through this trajectory to understand the, you know, the bigger scheme of things and sort of try to imbibe it
mm-hmm.
in some sort of yogic process, and then you come eventually to a place where you're ready for, is that necessarily true? So,
like, yeah, good. That's good, Coco. You know, the Bhagavatam, when you look at the sort of overall subject matter of the Bhagavatam, there's a lot of Aishwarya discussion in the first several cantos, of course. But you know what? Let me explain to you what I've discovered about the Aishwarya and the Madhurya in the most intimate setting of the Vrajagopikas. I've noticed that when the Vrajagopikas are with Krishna, the Aishwarya tends to recede and disappear. But when they're feeling the absence of Krishna, when they're longing for Krishna, they revisit the Aishwarya. And you can see this in the Gopi Gita. They recognize that, you know, you are the Lord. Everyone offers homage unto you. The great yogis and sages pursue your lotus feet. You know, they remember Krishna's greatness. But when they're with Krishna, immediately, they forget all that. So the Aishwarya, on a rasic level, has the function of intensifying vipralamba seva, of viraha. Does that make sense? When you miss someone so much, you remember so many things about them. But when they're right in front of you, you don't have to remember all those things. They're right there. So this is sort of natural. So, and honestly, when you know, I always like to tell the story of my son when I was teaching at Duke University, how I took my son he had a day off from school and he was bored and I said, well, I'm going to school to teach. He said, can I come? And I said, well, you must be really bored. You come with me to the school? So I took him and there were 50 kids in my class and it was an hour long. He sat in the back. And after everyone cleared out, after everyone was talking to me as they were leaving, they had to talk to me about their work. We were walking back to the car to go back home. And he kept looking at me weird. I said, is there something wrong? He said, I can't believe what happened back there. I said, what? What? I'm thinking the kids are not smoking dope in class or what's going on? And he said, I can't believe what I saw back there. I said, what did you see? He said, all those kids think you are really smart when I know you're really very dumb. I said, this is a good point. It's like he never saw me in that context. I act completely different there. At home, I am dumb. I admit. But at work, I'm a little smart. I'm trying to activate the smarts. There's where, you know, I mean, the Vrajagopikas, they can't even think of Krishna. Look, Maya has the function of forgetfulness. Now, in this world, she functions as causing us to forget our true identity as eternal selves. But in the spiritual world, she has the function of allowing Krishna to forget who he is so he can just interact with the Vrajagopikas freely. And the gopis forget who they are too. So forgetfulness has a very positive or very negative effect. And Yoga Maya is in charge of both. We sometimes refer to Mahamaya, you know, in the context of the phenomenal world and so on. So, does that help, Coco? Okay, good, good. Thank you for your question. Okay, we've got one back here. Oh, we have another here.
Can you tell me the difference between the left and the right politics of the gopis?
Oh.
Yeah. You know, there's the left.
Yeah, the Chandravali.
Yeah, Chandravali. Mm-hmm. And their attitude towards Krishna.
Yeah.
And their approach to Krishna.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be, I think, a talk for a more intimate setting. Yeah. You know, Mahaprabhu gives us the example of speaking the most confidential parts of our theology in more of an intimate, less formal setting, private, more of a private setting, you know. And in fact, if you recall the talk between Ramananda Roy and Mahaprabhu, that was a very private setting. And they, you know, Mahaprabhu kept asking Brahmananda Roy to go deeper, go deep, go deep, keep going, keep going. And at one point, he actually covers the mouth of Brahmananda Roy. Even certain things in that context shouldn't be said. It covers the mouth. So there is that, shall we say, sensitivity to our the most intimate dimensions of our theology. So that'll be something you and I can talk about together. Yeah.
I was just thinking of that book of Indra Swami. You used to talk about that side too.
Yeah.
In a very funny way.
Yeah. You know, Prabhupada's mood was to be extremely cautious about speaking about the most, you know, intimate dimensions of Madhurya Bhakti. So this is what I try to follow that. I mean, the best I can, the best way I know. Yeah. But it is a very amazing subject. And it's all, you know, I mean, it gets into the Rasic literature, it gets into, you know, Rupa Goswami's Bhakti Rasa, you know, and understanding the nature of Kavya and Sanskrit poetics and how that tradition is engaged in understanding the original, the origin of those poetics and so on. So it gets also complicated. Yeah. That's good. We have a comment over here. Where's the mic? Okay.
Hare Krishna. Thank you very much for your class. You were mentioning this point of you can't force love, and we worship a God that can't be forced. But Krishna in the 16th chapter, it may seem like this, but I'm just looking for an explanation. He says, "Tam aham drishtaha kruran," I perpetually cast you into the ocean of material existence. And I think the next verse he says, for those in that state, they can never approach me. It seems like the alternative to not surrendering to Krishna is very grim. So it seems like a kind of like a subtle force.
Yeah.
So how do we understand this?
Yeah. Very good. So my understanding is that there can be, see, you were quoting the 16th chapter, right?
Yeah.
It's a divine and demoniac natures, right? Well, if you're a demoniac, you might as well forget it. I mean, hang it up. I met someone the other day who was demonic. I said, hey, there's no hope for you. Go away. No, not really. But, you know, the idea is that people, I mean, the evil that humans are capable of, I mean, is so bad that they might as well never go back. I mean, really. And I think that Krishna is speaking there about that level of evil. You know, human beings, you know, we're terrible animals. We don't know how to be good animals. I mean, sometimes we say about someone to try to insult them, you know, you're just an animal. No, you're not even as good as an animal. Animals are really, I was just watching the birds out back. I saw the sign, don't feed the birds. Okay, whatever. Yeah. But I can sit there and appreciate the birds. And there are geese and ducks. Okay, and we've got geese and ducks behind our house. And in Virginia, you know, Virginia is a place in the U.S. Have you heard about the United States before? I don't know about these people here. I just got to borrow these. I've actually met Brits that didn't even know the United States existed, okay? Anyway, sorry. Anyway, but we've got geese and ducks in the back. I mean, these animals are programmed. You know, they're beautifully programmed. You know, night comes, they go to sleep. You know, I see that they eat certain things and not other things. They know what to eat, you know. They're mating seasons. They know how to mate, when to mate. And they defend, especially the mothers with their little chickies, you know. They defend. I mean, you understand that, right? But human beings, we don't know how to do any of these things. We're not instinct driven. We're culturally driven. And so defending, my gosh, we don't just defend, we offend. We are the only species that devises every possible way to make another human being suffer and die. It's unbelievable. It's so demonic. Yeah. Yeah. Some of those people should never. You know, I mean, I'm totally with that. You know, you can think of some people in history. They're probably there, okay? And that's where they should be. So, in one sense, if there is such evil that has been achieved, really, how does that ever get expiated? But you know what? It can. It actually can be. I mean, what if Hitler came to the manor? I probably wouldn't talk to him, but I would have you talk to him, or maybe you. Yeah, you'd be good. Yeah. Not Yadavar. I would have Yadavar talk to him and show him the film. Yeah, I'd have the whole setup. I'd make the whole thing perfect for Hitler. What he would need, you know. And then in the kitchen, you know, samosas. You know? He was a vegetarian. Believe it or not, Hitler was a vegetarian. You know, Hitler applied to art school, college. And he actually was a decent artist. I've actually seen some of his art. And he was denied admission. You realize that? Can you imagine if he had been accepted? You know, what I say to my students at the start of every semester, thank God you've been accepted by this university, because who knows what the hell you would do if you weren't, like Hitler. And looking at some of you, I could see some really bad things would have happened, so I'm glad you're here. And now I will take over. So I scare the heck out of my students, really. Yeah, so it's, you know, again, the more demonic, the more hellish, the more evil one embodies, the more, I mean, it's just so remote. But there's nothing called Vishuddha Tamas. There's no such thing as Vishuddha Tamas. But there is something called Vishuddha Sattva. You see? So our theology is intrinsically optimistic, even with such demonic entities around. There's no such thing as Vishuddha Tamas, no such thing as pure hell. I hope that was a little satisfactory. Any last comment, question at all from me? Yes.
I do think you've got it wrongly around. British people know everything about everything because we're in the middle of the world. And 80% of Americans don't have passports and they don't know anything about the world.
You want to step outside? It's not that I'm going to go with you. I'm just saying, you want to, do you want... Yeah. Well, I enjoy coming to England, especially because coming here, we both love it here. And the cows, you know, we have to go visit the cows, Krishnakanta, right? I mean, the cows. I was once here without Krishnakanta, and when the cows were just released after the winter, and I have never seen anything like it in my life. The cows come out and they are like, it's so funny. The rear ends jump higher than the fronts. And they're just so adorable. They are so adorable. They're so lovable, the cows. So we're going to have to visit the cows. Yeah. Okay, you'll take us to see the cows, Yadavar, right? Okay, good. So anyway, thank you so much for having me, and I hope to come back again with my wife, and all the best to all of you. Hare Krishna.